Thank you. A quorum being present, I will now call our Human Services Finance Committee to order for February 28th. Our first order of business is to approve the minutes for February 21st, 2023. Representative Pryor, have you had a chance to examine the notes?
Yes, I have, Madam Chair, and I move approval.
Thank you. All right. The minutes being moved, we will move on to our first agenda item. Oh, I'm sorry. To approve the minutes, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. Thank you. We will move then on to the next order of business for the day, which is House File 2286. Chair Noor is at the front of the room to present the bill. And first on that, Chair Noor, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 2286 to Health Finance and Policy Committee.
Thank you. Chair Noor moves that House File 2286 be re-referred to the Health Finance and Policy Committee. And with that, seeing no amendments, Chair Noor, would you like to present your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill is about the unwinding of the public health emergency after the delinking of the healthcare renewals from the PHE. Madam Chair and members, we had an extensive discussion of the unwinding previously. So this is something that is needed urgently. This is something that we have to act quickly. As you have heard from the Assistant Commissioner when she was here, declaring this is unprecedented, complex, and difficult. More than 1.5 million Minnesotans will be impacted. We also know that more than 40% of the recipients are children. Madam Chair and members, effective April 1, 2023, Minnesotans, along with others throughout the country, are required to maintain continuous eligibility will now be required to start the renewal process. Members, with this bill, we are creating an opportunity for Minnesotans who will lose their eligibility. If I start with Section 1, Section 1 is cost-sharing reduction. As we all know that many Minnesotans who are on Medicaid in Minnesota Care also will no longer qualify. According to the estimates, it's upwards of more than 200,000. To ensure that everyone has got a coverage, this cost-sharing reduction that will be established effective January 2024 will ensure individuals who are on the silver plan above 200% but below 250% to qualify for reduction. If you put into context, this is for an individual, it's going to be 27,000, and for a couple, it's going to be 46,000. For a family of household of four, it's going to be 70,000. Members, during the pandemic, we had a great opportunity to have the tax credit, which reduced the cost of the premiums to the individuals. With the reduction of the premiums comes co-pays, co-insurance, and other payments that are required for the individual to pay in order to continue their eligibility. We also know that, according to the data, 4 in 10 Americans have put their care to a different timeline because they could not afford the cost. We also know that many Minnesotans are unable to afford to pay for their care due to the cost, and they may even apply to file for bankruptcy. So what this section will do is it will increase the amount to 86, I believe it's going to be from 73% to reduce to, let me get my number straight here. The cost reduction will essentially make it just within 13% of the cost rather than 27%. this is a critical component that we need to ensure, and it goes through the MNSHUA system. And I'd like to ask the department to come and explain a little bit further before I move to the next level, if the MNSHUA in the agency is around here. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Noor. With that, we will start with our testifiers. Our first on the list is Ann Bobst.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to get the MNSHUA group so that we can address the first section, which is under the MNSHUA cost reduction.
My apologies, Chair Noor. Do we have someone from the agency here? Mr. Englund, I'd like to take a seat and state your name and your affiliation for the record.
Well, thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Pete Engler. I'm the Government Affairs Manager at MNSHUR. Wasn't anticipating to testify today. I know we will be, this will be heard in House Health Finance on Thursday as well. But to give a little bit more information of what Chair Noor mentioned of this this item would do is that it would essentially, for individuals and families from 200 up to 250% of the federal poverty line, these individuals would have their cost sharing reductions. Essentially, their plans would increase in their actuarial value from 73 up to 87% actuarial value, so that their cost sharing of their plans would go down from about 27% to about 13%. That's essentially what this does. We can definitely provide more information to members of the committee going forward here, but for an overview, that's what this provision would do in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Engler. Chair Noor, do you have any rebuttal?
Based on the information, this will create the opportunity for individuals who may lose their coverage during the unwinding to be able to apply for the cost sharing reduction. As you've had, this is an expensive cost to many members. And the CSR is already available through the federal government, which increases to 73%. So I think this is a much needed cost sharing reduction under the state proposal. Madam Chair, members, if we move to the second section of the bill, this addresses the eligibility for children who are under age 21, and also, so this addresses the need for us to do the continuous coverage for children under age 6. And this also includes also children under age 21 for the continuous coverage of 12 months. What happens is if we see an individual loses their coverage within the 12 months that they are eligible, essentially because of the churn that happens, change of circumstance, change of household, change of income, that creates a big burden for those who are in the system. So with this section, we're increasing the continuous eligibility, which is now authorized under federal rule. So what we are asking for essentially is to continue the eligibility for children. Also, we have included here the continuous eligibility for children under age 6, which is much needed, and other states have already received the waiver. This will be under 1115 waiver that we have to apply for the state to in order to allow that continuous eligibility. Some of the changes in this bill is modification of waivers that allows the department to continue eligibility under the new rules in medical assistance and Minnesota care. We also include in this bill funding for individuals through the Navigator program, through the work number for verification of income, through the counties so that they're able to continue to do the unwinding, but also an outreach program that will help us to address this issue as we are dealing with the unwinding. Madam Chair and members, I know we have got a fiscal note. I just wanted to ask if Mr. Burke can just walk us through the fiscal No.
Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair and members, you should have in your packet a letter size spreadsheet. And I will note it still says House File XXXX at the top. We're working on this. It is actually 2289, as you see. And this shows the bill as it stands right now. There, I believe, will be an amendment in the next committee that will change this somewhat, but I'll just go over the items as they are now. In summary, line one is a governor's initiative on employment and income verification that costs $1 million a year. Lines two through seven are the governor's initiative for continuous eligibility that Representative Noor just spoke of. Lines 8 through 15 are the responding to COVID. This is really the unwinding and the redetermination portion. And then in addition, on lines 17 and 18 are grants to counties to assist them with the unwinding. And lines 19 and 20 include outreach information so that the Department of Human Services can contact people to make sure they know what's going on and don't lose coverage. Lines 21 through 25 show the federal offset on those various items I mentioned, and then the MNSURE cost sharing reductions are on line 29. So in summary, if you go to line 31, the net general fund cost after federal reimbursement or offset is $2.3 million in 23, $132.8 million in 24 and 25, and $156.7 million in 26, 27. And if there are any questions about specific lines on there, I can go through those.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Berg, for the walkthrough. Chair Noor.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And also included in your packet, you can see the editorial from the Star Tribune reflecting on the daunting challenge for healthcare as we address the issue of the unwinding, and even the recent article that was posted too. With that, Madam Chair, I would like to ask my testifiers to come to the table and testify.
Thank you, Chair Noor. With that, we will now start with our testifiers, our first being Ann Volks. If you would please come forward. Thank you, Ms. Volks. If you would please state your name and your affiliation for the record.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Noor and members, for the record, my name is Ann Bopst and I'm with the Department of Human Services. As the committee may remember from Assistant Commissioner Cynthia McDonald's recent committee presentation, DHS will be undertaking an immense effort to redetermine eligibility for the nearly 1.5 million Minnesotans who are currently enrolled in medical assistance and Minnesota Care due to the continuous eligibility requirements of the federal Families First Coronavirus Response Act. Due to changes passed in Congress at the end of 2022, all states are able to begin this redetermination process as of April 1st. As you heard in AC McDonald's presentation, DHS does have a request in the governor's budget to address the agency's needs to undertake this process and to work to make it as seamless as possible for our enrollees. We thank Chair Noor for bringing House File 2286 forward, which contains these provisions from the governor's budget, as well as includes additional resources for counties and outreach to enrollees, and language similar to the governor's budget proposal related to continuous eligibility for children. We respectfully request that the legislature pass the provisions related to eligibility redeterminations as soon as possible so that DHS and our partners have adequate resources in place to begin redeterminations in the coming months. And we look forward to working with Chair Noor on this bill as it moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bobst. All right, next we have Matt Freeman, if you could come forward. Thank you. Welcome to the table, Mr. Freeman. If you could state your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Chair Noor. My name is Matt Freeman. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators and Human Service Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm here on behalf of counties to advocate for additional resources as the legislature and this committee considers and prepares for the unwinding of the federal public health emergency. I'm here speaking on behalf of the human service directors and county commissioners across our state. County staff are the folks who will be processing the 1.5 million individual enrollment eligibilities for the public health care programs in Minnesota. Since January in 2020, we've seen a 30% increase in the number of beneficiaries across the state. That increase leads to an increase in caseloads and work for our county staff. You know well from previous presentations that medical assistance and Minnesota care cover the most vulnerable populations in our state, with 40% of them being our state's children, or representing 40% of our state's children. We recognize the governor's ask for $23 million to cover increased costs for the end of the continuous enrollment, and counties support that, knowing that we need those resources at the state level to support our work locally as well. However, counties are the folks who process the most applications for medical assistance, and counties are going to face that increased administrative burden. With the increase in 30% of enrollments, we're going to see increases in caseloads. And with the unwinding, nearly every case will need to be touched and amended in the next 12 months. County staff have been unable to update cases and make adverse changes to enrollment during the continuous enrollment period. So this will significantly impact how many cases can auto-renew versus those that have to be manually renewed and processed, which is more time-intensive and challenging. It's really important both for the eligibility workers and for the staff who are doing additional follow-up for timely response and outreach to those who are eligible but run into barriers for re-enrollment, that we have resources to follow up with members of our communities. I want to thank Chair Noor for partnering with counties in seeking resources to conduct the increased enrollments and for drafting $36 million in grants for counties to assist with the unwinding. In determining that ask or that number, the statewide association did outreach to a diverse group of counties regarding their need and their capacity to turn around new resources quickly for use during the unwinding. We were able to come to that number by utilizing a number of methodologies based on the number of renewals, estimating the time to conduct those renewals, creating a base estimate cost on wages for the staff doing renewals, and we would recommend that an allocation of those dollars be across the state based on a percentage of the Medicaid population. If you look in your packet, there is a handout of this allocation or what to give you a sense of what those allocations may be by county and how that might impact at a county by county level. I'd want to emphasize as well the need for this funding to be flexible, as the needs and ability to bring new staff in short order is going to be challenging, and targeting this high volume period will require different approaches county by county. We expect that these resources will be essential not only for supporting overtime and additional staff, but for needs such as call center costs to triage urgent and emergent situations, new technology to support that work, community outreach, and renewal support. So lastly, I want to again thank Chair Noor for his inclusion of these resources for counties. I'm happy to speak in greater detail to our methodology, and I have a colleague here from Hennepin County who can also speak to the experience of determining that methodology. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you so much, Mr. Freeman, and thank you for the resource as well, breaking it down by counties. I think that's very useful to the members. Thank you for that. Next, we have Kate Heffernan. Welcome, Ms. Heffernan. If you could state your name and affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kate Heffernan. I lead economic supports at Hennepin County. I'm a senior department administrator there, and I'm the co-chair of the Self-Sufficiency Committee of the Minnesota Association of Social Service Administrators. I want to thank Chair Knorr, and I'm glad to be here today in support of this bill and here to speak specifically to the estimate of county workload increase for the healthcare unwind. Minnesota counties will be responsible for the majority of the resident-facing work of unwinding the healthcare renewals for medical assistance over the next year. County costs for this work are extraordinarily high, and state investment is needed to ensure residents are able to access health care. The renewal process will start as a completely manual, paper-based process. Many of the efforts to develop expedited lower-touch renewals are still underway at DHS, and we're told to anticipate significantly fewer auto renewals than we had prior to 2020. Cases are spread across two different eligibility systems, which increases staff training time and increases complexity to manage the work. One of the systems doesn't give counties data access, making work tracking and efficient management nearly impossible. The other is so old that it is a literal black screen, which experienced workers can navigate efficiently, but has a steep learning curve for new staff. County staff will begin much of this work with residents in March, but once we get to the first renewal month of July, counties will begin also dealing with case closures or churn. As the months progress, county staff will have up to three additional types of healthcare renewal work in addition to the case maintenance for cases that aren't renewing and processing new applications coming in. Since it can take up to a year to develop proficiency in using the computer systems, and many of our staff have been hired after 2020, meaning they've never had to process a renewal, we developed our projection with a plan to deploy existing staff with system proficiency to process renewals, allowing us to add or contract additional help to carry out outreach support to reduce the confusion among residents and to get ahead of some of the influx of contacts that we expect from people who have never had healthcare renewals, had a healthcare renewal before, don't understand the process, and or have a case that closes. Using this assumption, we focused our cost estimate on additional supports for before, during, and after the renewal process that would supplement the existing county staff experts now being trained to process renewals. The funding request is based on a combination of supplementing county call centers or offices to take inbound contacts and outreach contacts with hands-on help for before and during renewals, targeted at households at risk of case closure, and then after renewals when cases do close. The estimate was based on number of hours. For the call center in-office support, we estimated time for contacts per case, assuming that the actual time per case would vary greatly across households. For the additional supports before, during, and after the renewal process, we assumed outreach activities with a portion of the caseload and included both quick reminder time as well as allotting time for hands-on help with paperwork for a subset of the cases that need it. Thank you, and I'm available for questions if needed.
Thank you, Ms. Heffernan, and I appreciate you walking us through the assumptions around those figures. That also is extremely helpful. Next, we have Dimitri Kelly, if you would like to come forward.
Hello and good afternoon.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly. If you could go ahead and state your name and your affiliation for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Yes. Hello and good afternoon, members of the committee. Thank you, Chair Knorr, for the invitation to educate the committee about the challenges facing navigator organizations in Minnesota. My name is Demetria Kelly, and I'm the director of the Navigator Coalition. The Navigator Coalition is comprised of 32 member organizations that provide MNSURE certified navigator assistance to community members to enroll in or maintain coverage through MNSURE. Our mission is to achieve a sustainable navigator system that ensures all Minnesotans have access to affordable health care. Navigator organizations are funded through MNSURE grants and per enrollee payment of $70 for each enrollment. As we unwind from the public health emergency, navigators are an essential component of helping Minnesotans maintain coverage, and their organizational capacity to adequately meet the demands regarding outreach, processing applications, and enrollment assistance will be critical in the upcoming months. With racial disparities in healthcare coverage growing and an unprecedented number of Minnesotans expected to renew their Minnesota healthcare program coverage starting April 2023, less than 45 days away, the need for Minsure Certified Navigator services has never been higher. This increased demand is occurring at a time when many navigator organizations have had to reduce their navigator workforce or end navigator services since the federal public health emergency was declared in March of 2020. As medical assistance and Minnesota care renewals were halted due to the PHE navigator revenue resulting from enrollments dropped by over 40%. Many have had to lay off staff and downsize their operations. Minnesota healthcare program enrollment has reached historic levels at over 1.5 million enrollees. DHS projects thousands of enrollees could lose coverage through the renewal process. While the uninsured rate in Minnesota reached a historic low of 4% in 2021, the uninsured rate for Black, Indigenous, people of color, Minnesotans climbed to 10.2%. This disparity in coverage is projected to increase when enrollees are required to renew coverage. BIPOC Minnesotans and Minnesotans with limited English proficiency are at greater risk of losing coverage compared to white Americans, or white Minnesotans, excuse me. Navigators are critical to ensuring Minnesotans successfully renew and maintain healthcare coverage. Navigators provide hands-on, culturally responsive application and renewal assistance, resulting in more complete and timely renewals. This support will be essential to reducing the anticipated historic loss of healthcare coverage by Minnesotans facing barriers to healthcare access in hard-to-reach communities. Thank you for your consideration, and I stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly, and I want to apologize. I may have mispronounced your first name. My apologies on that, but really am grateful for the perspective that you bring to the discussion. Thank you so much. All right. Before we move any further forward, I just want to make sure, is there anyone else in the public that wishes to testify on the bill? Thank you for coming. If you'd like to state your name and affiliation, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Noor, and our apologies. I think we were on the testifier list and I just missed the agenda. My name is Stephanie Radke. I am the president of Portico HealthNet, and we are the largest nonprofit navigator organization in the state, and we've been doing this work and supporting healthcare access for about 25 years. I am here on behalf of the 21 navigator organizations that signed the navigator letter in your packet. I want to thank you for the opportunity to share the challenges that Minnesota's community-based navigator organizations face as we move forward with the public health emergency and the ending of the public health emergency and unwinding continuous coverage for Minnesota healthcare programs. Up to 1 in 4 Minnesotans will be required to renew their public program coverage over the next 14 months. And as noted, we expect unprecedented demand on community navigator organizations, local county processing agencies, and our health systems. Creating a coordinated and adequately funded approach will be essential to reducing unnecessary gaps in coverage, increasing equity and access, and reaching those most in need of assistance. A robust and effective statewide navigator network will be the front line of the healthcare coverage re-enrollment effort. Navigators are trusted community members who are often members of underserved communities, speak the native languages of our neighbors, and ensure culturally aware services. Our outreach and application assistance results in greater awareness of program benefits and requirements, more complete applications to local county processing agencies, and overall increased program and enrollment. Unfortunately, the pandemic and inflation has negatively impacted many Navigator organizations, and funding has been stagnant. The continuous coverage granted to enrollees during the COVID-19 pandemic has led to significant decreases in incentive payments from Minsure Navigator organizations who depend on these payments to support their work. As noted, all certified Navigator organizations are eligible for incentive payments or per enrollment payments for each person they successfully assist in submitting an application or required program renewal. As a result of the decrease in per enrollee payments, many Navigator organizations have had to lay off staff and reduce capacity over the last few years. We'd like to thank Chair Noor for moving this bill quickly and for the Navigator funding that is included in the DHS appropriations that is part of this bill. Authorizing the disbursement of this year's incentive funds that were already allocated to Navigator incentive payments will allow Navigator organizations to build capacity and prepare for the ending of the public health emergency. The funding in this bill, which we are very grateful for, will help us prepare for the unwinding. But in our letter, we also ask for an increase in the incentive payment from $70 to $100 with a built-in cost of living adjustment, a COLA, and an overall annual base grant funding increase from $4 million to $10 million during the continuous coverage unwinding, and the ongoing base grant increase from $4 million to $7 million with the built-in cost of living adjustment. We hope that these additional funding requests can be considered as part of the Health and Human Services budget discussions. These requests are essential to support the long-term sustainability of community-based Navigator organizations and reflect the cost of doing this work. As noted earlier, a robust statewide network of Navigators will be a critical community partner and ensure a smooth end to the public health emergency and continued health care coverage for low-income Minnesotans. Thank you for your consideration, and I stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Radke, and my apologies that our agenda was askew for you, as well as for members. We do just want to make sure that we are being thoughtful about pointing out, as the testifier had mentioned, Ms. Radke, we do have an item in your packet from the Minnesota Navigator Coalition, as well as a letter that refers to the cost of living adjustments and some other items that were referenced during the testimony. All right. Anyone else from the public that we have that would like to testify on the bill before we move to member discussion? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion, and we do have a question. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Noor, for bringing this forward. And what I was hoping to hear, and if we could hear more comments on, again, the real importance of this bill, which, you know, as we heard the different testifiers say, we're talking about eliminating gaps in coverage for people. So, and, you know, any one of us can think, like, oh, there's a time when, some people may not know what it was like not to have insurance, that maybe that you're fortunate in your life you've never had that. But for those of us that do know what it's like not to have insurance, you don't get care. And when you don't get care, that's when your more major problems happen. And whether it's the adult that's trying to work, the person taking care of the family, or the children in the family, these are critical issues. So I appreciate, we're having a little bit of discussion, but if the bill author and Terry Noor, if you could go in again about how we're going to do everything that we can to make sure that people stay signed up for the health care that they're entitled to, would appreciate those comments again.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, Chair Pryor, I think this is really critical. We understand that access to healthcare coverage is the first step to preventative healthcare, to many other needs for individuals, especially with low income. And let me underline this. The individuals who are unsheltered are the individuals who really deserve to be included. So if they don't renew their coverage, and there's a lapse in the process, they lose that coverage completely. That means they're burdened with financial needs that they cannot afford. That means they cannot even seek any health care. That means they may become even more sicker because we have not provided them with the tools that they need to ensure that we do have that continuous coverage. One thing that we have seen during the pandemic, for the last 3 years, there was no need for renewal process. That meant that we increased the coverage by 300,000 individuals and never dropped anyone. And yes, there are seniors who are, some of them who are disabled individuals and many more. In this bill, we disregard their assets. The asset limit for an individual who's senior is 3,000. I can guarantee you there are many seniors who have more than 3,000 right now. And if we renew with the current process, that means they lose their coverage. For a senior individual, for individual with disability who really deserves to have that safety net in place, they will not continue to have that. So this is a life saving. It's a matter of life and death for so many members in our community and across the state.
Thank you.
Representative Pryor? Okay. All right, then we will move on to Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on the fiscal note, it was indicated that there is an amendment coming which would change the fiscal note. I think it'd be nice for this committee to understand the structure of the amendment and what sort of degree of change to the fiscal note.
Certainly, I will refer that to the chair, but obviously we do not have the amendment before us, which makes it a little challenging, but certainly if you'd like to make comment, Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Quam, I think there were some few numbers that were inaccurate in some sense, and we wanted to make sure that we reflect what is already included in the big book that we provided everyone, so this makes some few corrections. Likewise, under the Navigator program, we have that 1.96, and there was an included language that says that we have to look into the quarter of 2020 and 2021, I believe, to make sure that the process that had been negotiated by the Navigators is included in there. So I'd like to ask if, by any chance, Mr. Berg has got the revised process, just to inform the committee what that will look like.
Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, I think I followed all of that. I was answering the question at the same time. In summary, the total change dollar-wise in the amendment will take it from in 24-25 on the bottom line is 132.8 million. That will move to 142.2 million in the amendment to add in the portion that Representative Noor referenced, the premium, zero premiums, and some other adjustments where the numbers were just not accurate. The tails numbers don't change. Oh, and I should make a reference that it. Some confusion. If you look at the spreadsheet, all of the money is going to be coming out of the healthcare access fund. The language in the one of the things that the amendment will do is change the language in the appropriation section that currently references the general fund, but all appropriations are meant to come out of the healthcare access fund.
Thank you, Mr. Berg, for the clarification. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the clarification. It did seem to indicate that there was enough knowledge to where we could get that glimpse, and it's good that we find out it's about $20 million bump. The other thing is when the testifier with the county was talking about all of this paperwork-driven work on this requalification, $1.5 million. Requalifications. It seemed as if there was a lot of training and maybe time, effort, and cumbersomeness that's going to be going on. What kind of impact to the time scale plus additional resources and delays in being able to do the requalification would, there are several bills, including one we'll hear later, that is increasing the burden on this activity by doing a automatic voter registration and that type of activity, which includes some verification of citizenship, all this other, you know, something that's outside of what they're normally doing. So I'd like to understand some of the other proposals interacting with your bill. How much at risk are we putting this requalification of 1.5 million people or cases?
Thank you, Representative Quam. Just to clarify, I believe the language in that bill does specify that that is if the agency deems that it is able, if it has the data and is able to do so. We don't know if that is actually the case here, just to be clear. But Chair Noor, would you like to speak to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're not discussing yet House File 3, so I think that can wait for the House File 3. But I'll mention this, that for more than 3 years, the staff at the county level and navigators and even at the state level, we haven't done any renewals. So it comes to understanding the rules, the policies, and the changes that we have to implement. And this is not going to be something done at once. It's going to take some time. The first batch, I think people will lose coverage, is effective July. And then we have to continue unwinding it for 12 months when we start, when we begin the unwinding. So that means we have enough time to do the cohort so that we are able to send notification to individuals and process the required, within the required timeline. And I'm hopeful, I think during this time period, as we continue to do the coverage, we provide those protection to the individuals in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author. I want to feel good that we aren't going to put at risk or delay this important activity, which is a major undertaking and should have priority for us because so many people are going to be impacted. I mean, that's a pretty good sized number for a state of our size. And I think it would behoove us to really understand the risk, because we've already been hearing about a shortage of personnel, you know, issues with some of the IT and support structures. And we always know that things coming from the feds sometimes need clarification, or they get changed or shifted, especially if this is stretching across the year. I just don't want us to throw so much on the counties and the agencies that they won't be able to accomplish their the priority of helping all the people that need these services, you know, from the state. So if we could get to the committee members a better idea of the level of impact, the stress points, the stretch plan for implementation, because when this bill, I assume, is going to hit the floor and pass, that we take care of any contingencies or avoid any unintended consequences and hardship, because I don't want to have something pop up in the middle of summer to where we'd have to have a special session or come back next year to fix an issue that we could have avoided if we just had the information and did it. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam, and I know we are certainly appreciative that we all have great concerns and lots of questions about how things will work out. Mr. Chair, do you have any follow-up comment before we move on to the next question?
Madam Chair, I think this is an important issue. It's really critical that we get it right. Mm-hmm. And it's something that we have put it as a top priority, because it's much needed, not for Hennepin, but across the state. So I can assure you there will be a lot of burnout. Many people are, you know, work at the county. This is a stressful process. they'll be working overtime, even at the state level. So we want to ensure that we provide them the resource that they need to make sure they hire individuals, they train individuals, and they process the cases. This is, as I noted, this is about life and death. And we want to make sure that no one, no Minnesotans who is eligible for medical assistance or Minnesota care, or even shifting them to the Minsure, the tax credit, loses that opportunity. So this is a high time. This is a critical moment. This is a high priority for all of us, and we have to get it right.
Thank you. Next, we have Representative Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Knorr. The good news is we all agree that this needs to be a high priority. That's the very good news. I also just want to make a comment quickly on the cost sharing reductions. Frankly, it's not really strictly related to the renewal process, but I appreciate your approach of addressing cost sharing when it comes to medical assistance. I think that that is a good, positive approach and makes sense. We're talking about the Minnesotans who need that help the most, and I appreciate that you are not including other groups who don't need a cost sharing benefit. Those of us in this room on CGIP are probably okay. So I appreciate that what you did include and what you didn't include. I do have some questions on, I'm really trying to understand how these appropriations are being broken out, and perhaps you'll offer more clarity with an amendment. But right now, these feel very vague to me as I read this language, and so I'm looking for a little more clarity. You can imagine that, I mean, we talked about when the department gave us the presentation on this a couple of weeks ago. Certainly, my concern was for the counties, because the counties do the bulk of this work. The counties are the ones who have to actually dig in and do the work. And so I'm concerned that with almost $300 million in appropriations in this bill, only $36 million is going to the counties. And with 87 counties, that money will go very fast, particularly when, obviously we've got Hennepin and Ramsey and Dakota. We've got some counties that are very large and will have a ton of renewals to do, but every county will be affected. And so I'm a little concerned about the balance in the bill for that reason. And so I'm wondering if you can go through and explain a little bit more. So, for example, technology system costs. I mean, what does that relate to? We heard from the department that they were doing this website tool, this dashboard. But the counties don't need that dashboard to do the renewals. It's almost a matter of curiosity more than anything else. I hope that we're not funding that instead of funding more for the counties, things like that.
Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Lead New Brindley. I think just to go up, talking about the numbers, I think Doug can provide us more details, but I'll start with the IT section. I think there's $1 million that is for the work number, whereby we can use that system to actually verify incomes for the individual. And also, let me note this. Some of these processes that we're doing, there's also some federal funding participation that we may end up receiving, depending on how we do the reporting. And the other sections, I think it's more direct that we have got for the cost sharing reduction. That is more straightforward in terms of the numbers. We talk about changes to MAXIS, MMIS, and the other program that is used for the healthcare renewal process. Those are ongoing costs, too. So it's not only one time. Once we do under Subdivision 1, that will provide more resources for updating the income information, updating, making those changes that are reflected in the continuous eligibility coverage. So I don't want to belabor you. I think some of this is already included in the big book in terms of explaining how the detail of that funding is used. And I hope we can provide the page numbers. Sometimes it's what is buried in the big book in order to understand line by line. I think Mr. Burke can help us a little bit.
Mr. Burke.
Madam Chair, Representative Noor, I can certainly email the page numbers out to the committee later. I don't have them right at hand. There are two lines on the spreadsheet that are related to IT systems costs. They're lines 7 and 15. And you'll see on line 7, as Chairman Noor was referencing, there are ongoing costs relative to the continuous eligibility IT changes. And then in line 15, there are one-time costs relative to the redetermination portion of it that are IT. Those are the IT costs that are in here.
Thank you. Chair Noor?
I think Mr. Beck covered.
Okay. Madam Chair. Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I guess I would reiterate that question, because there are ongoing costs. We understand ongoing IT costs, but that initial cost is actually almost $7 million. I think a million was referenced. There's $1 million for staffing costs, additional staffing costs, but there's $7 million for technology systems. And again, I would just want to know, is that for income verification, or is that for a dashboard? Or are all of those things included in that? And I guess I would just, well, let's see if we can figure that out to start.
Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, Lead New Brindley, I can assure you, I think we've already paid for the dashboard. It's something that is, going to be included for the renewal process. So it's a place where people can reference that is not included here. If I'm wrong, I'll send you the notes, because I was informed that that was an ongoing process that was already undertaken. So the pieces for the technology, I think it's more clear based on what Mr. Buck just expressed. And I know it's costly. There's a lot of changes that needs to be implemented for us to be able to process 1.5 million renewals. So you can imagine that the cost associated with the technology is quite clear. The piece that I mentioned was the additional one of the work number, which is outside the department, so that county workers and everyone can use to verify income, and that's a small amount, which I think it's listed on the fiscal note, which you have it in your packet. I don't have it in front of me, but you have it in the packet.
Thank you. Lee New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Noor. And I'm wondering if you can offer a little bit more clarity as well. Subdivision 3 under Section 5, Central Office Healthcare, appropriated for contract costs. So there's $10 million initially with some ongoing costs. What are those contracts? Are those the is that also income eligibility? Like, what are those contracts that we're talking about?
Thank you. I do also want to just remind us, we do have three other folks on the list, and I know we are already at 2 o'clock, just to be cognizant of time for members and questions. Thank you, Lead New Brindley. Mr. Chair, if you'd like to respond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the moment that I phone a friend, so to make sure we can get someone from the department who can help us and guide us.
Thank you for coming forward to assist. Please state your name and your affiliation for the record, and proceed with your answer.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. I'm Anna Ashby from the Department of Human Services. Representative New Brindley, the line related to the contract costs, and I need to pull up the table in front of me, is related to agency project management support to help us kind of coordinate with our eligibility systems, with all of the sort of implications for our work with managed care organizations, with county support, with communications, just kind of spearheading that sort of interagency and interdivision work that needs to happen to make this as successful as possible.
All right. Thank you for that answer. Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that. And are those contracts already, do those contracts already exist? Do you need to do an RFP for those? Is that an existing relationship?
Madam Chair.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley, this is an existing contract that DHS has already procured, put out an RFP for, and has been working with. So this is additional contract costs to recognize different work that the contract needs to contemplate, including like task orders for work that we're identifying as we continue to move forward on the project.
Thank you for the clarification. Lead New Brindley, just a reminder, we do have three members and they are all on your side of the aisle.
Great.
And we do need to get to the second bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Knorr, my last question, and I'm trying to figure out where this is in the appropriations, but I'm trying to understand the Navigator funding and where that is in the appropriation and how that compares to what we've done in the past. We've been trying to look into it. It's a little bit difficult to find, but it looks like, I mean, there was a $2 million appropriation for Navigators previously, and it sounds like we currently, they receive a $70 fee. We're asking that to go to a $100 fee, but I'm trying to understand the Navigator portion of this, and it sounds like we're putting quite a bit of money into this Navigator system. Where does that show up in these appropriations? And can you just explain more clearly what exactly we're putting into that compared to what we do now?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That it will be under Subdivision 5, which is line 6.31, page 6. I will also like to phone a friend again. But just to explain, we're doing 1.936, which is carryover from fiscal year 2023, and then an ongoing, which is in the base of 4 million and some change, although this shows 1 million, it's a 4 million that is ongoing in the base. So we will be making that adjustment to reflect on that change.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. If you'd like to go ahead and answer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The Navigator grant, yes, we're working on adjusting this language in the amendment. The intent is both to have a carry forward of 1.936 million that recognizes the underspending that we've had in this area as a result of not doing the new renewals through the continuous coverage period, and then also recognizes an additional $3 million into the existing pot of funds for Navigator organizations, that $70 reimbursement fund, and then also additional funding for Navigator organizations to increase that amount.
Thank you. New Brindy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my last question is just to Mr. Berg. Can you just clarify, did you indicate that on the fiscal note, none of this money is coming out of the general fund? Is it all coming from the healthcare access fund?
Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley, yes, that's my understanding that that's the author's intent.
Okay. Thank you.
And I should clarify, based on the last thing, just because I know it will be confusing when you see the amendment, the subdivision you were referencing there in Minnesota Care, which the Navigator grants, there will be a Minnesota Care section there, but it will actually be Minnesota, it will be related to the premium issue. The Navigator grants are actually going to, and they should be in what is now Subdivision 7 healthcare grants. So when we amend this, the Navigator grant portion that Ms. Ashby just referred to will move to what is now Subdivision 7, but there will still be a Minnesota Care section. So I know that will be confusing.
And the Madam Chair, the county grants will still come be in that section as well?
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley, there are actually three items that will be in that budget activity: the county grants, the outreach, the new outreach money, and the Navigator grants that Ms. Ashby referred to. Those three will all be in the revamped health care grants budget activity.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. And with that, I'll give the chair a moment to rebut before we move on to our next testifier. I do want to let the committee know that we do have permission to extend our time here if necessary. I know members have other things going on, but we do need to get to that second bill today. Chair Noor, do you have anything else to add? All right, then let's go to Representative Baker.
Thank you, members and Madam Chair. I guess
a lot of my questions have been answered. I don't think I will need to speak much to this. I agree. This is a urgent matter. We have to fix this. I've been visiting with my folks at home about the Navigator program, what they need. They see this is coming in waves, or sitting on their hands and just kind of waiting for the feds to kind of give them some direction as well. This is a big problem. But what this legislation has this session to members is we have to land a lot of planes from COVID. And this is what this is part of. We have to bring it home and help our staff and help our workforce get back on track. I'm not exactly sure when the continuous eligibility didn't have to be worked and formatted and kind of, you know, molded throughout the last couple of years. They must have been doing something. I'm sure they were staying busy because they've had that, I don't want to call it a lull. I know they've been doing stuff. But now we've got to get it back on, and this is going to be an incredible load. But I just want to say that this is an urgent matter, that we will get through it. We'll figure out how to get it funded. But this is no different than life and death with nursing homes. It is no different than us helping them land after COVID, after the folks that ran out of the industry, that couldn't handle it anymore. We're in that same place with our folks that have nowhere to go, and the hospitals can't discharge, and all these things that are backing up. That is urgent, just like this is. I appreciate the work on this, Representative Knorr, and your understanding of this urgency of it too. But please, let's make sure that these other big areas that are really plugging up our medical systems in the state, including this eligibility, I agree we can't let folks fall through the cracks. But remember this when you think of nursing homes and you think of those people that we don't have in those areas because of reimbursement rates, and we can fix those quickly. We need to do that quickly. You can do this now in this area. Let's do it again with that as well. I'm on board to help out trying to figure this out. But again, I know there's other stops, but we have a lot of projects, major projects that are life and death, that we have to land this session to get people back on their feet after life after COVID. We got to get back there. So I appreciate that comments, and thank you for your work on this, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Baker. I think we all appreciate the urgency of the multiple priorities that we have to juggle. With that, I have Representative Zalesnikar, followed by Representative Franson, and then we will get to a vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Knorr. I've enjoyed talking to you about this issue, and when I met with constituents, I met with 50 providers, and they're all saying this. I've looked, St. Louis County is, I think, fifth of the number cases. Behind Hennepin and Ramsey, we got large numbers of people, so I've been worried about this too. So one, thank you for taking a lead on this. I wanted to ask you a question on your thoughts. When I listened to the testifiers today, it just made me wonder here, and if there was a significant period of time where reassessments were waived, is it fair to say care level needs may not have been updated with corresponding funding for nursing homes and assisted livings for elderly waiver clients who are cared for?
Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Zalesnikar, I think during that time period, Everyone who was eligible, in fact, we increased the number of people who are eligible for the program by 300,000, almost 300,000. So that meant that everyone had coverage, they were receiving the care that they needed, and they were able to stay in their settings. If we don't do the renewal, let's say someone who's in a long-term care, that there's no renewal on their medical assistance program, guess what? The nursing home facility or any facility will not be allowed to discharge that individual, and there will be a lapse in that process. So This is critical to making sure that anyone who's in the long-term care, in fact, gets the coverage. Likewise, as I noted earlier on, some of them may have increased their assets. We're disregarding the assets for until the next renewal so they can spend down their asset limit. So this is a great moment for us to step up in making sure that no one in a long-term care loses their coverage at this moment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zalesnikar, I'm sorry, I can't see you.
Oh, you either. I'm sorry.
Do you have any follow-up, or
yes.
Can we move to the next?
Yeah, no, and I 100% concur. I just, with the eligibility being eligible, if the needs changed for a resident during this emergency time, is it possible that a resident could have went from being independent in CARES to assist of one to assist of two without having a reassessment done that would correlate to an accurate care plan? And my reason for asking that is when I look at the number of fines that assisted livings received during this emergency period that we're now unwinding, I wonder if we potentially find people in our assisted living in nursing home side when we knew we weren't having assessments done timely that would have an accurate care plan from a team. It's just an observation. And it is nothing we can do because I agree we got to land the plane and we got to fix things. I 100% concur with you. As I've said before, we can't have a gap right now. We can't have people go without being appropriately placed. But I think the issues we are faced with in long-term care and nursing homes have to be addressed on the piece of, you know, we've accused people of neglect allegations and we didn't have assessments done. And in the world of healthcare, if you're a nurse and you're an aide and you're being accused of a neglect in one base of work, it probably is fair to say we aren't accusing social workers or case managers of neglect because we understood we were under emergency procedures. I would hope that as a bipartisan group, we figure out a solution to this because that's not how we treated nursing homes and assisted livings. And I just think it's something we have to look at. And it's an observation as I listened today that we weren't doing assessments, and people are acknowledging that during COVID.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to just note that we are hoping to get to a vote by 2:45 because we do want to be respectful also of Representative Greenman, who is already in the wings waiting for the next bill. Do you have any final commentary on that, Representative or Chair Noor?
To the question or statement, I think this is about eligibility process, and there was no change in terms of the care plans and several other things, which is separate from the eligibility. I'm sure the case managers and others have been doing their work during the difficult moment that we're in, so this is just about the eligibility for medical assistance in Minnesota.
And I appreciate that, Chair Noor, because I hate to see anybody have a gap, and I totally agree that this income levels, we know they're over 3,000. There's no way. We didn't have families and friends coming in to help them manage assets. We have mail stacked up from what providers tell me. So I think this is a great initiative that we have to address. So I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Zalesnikar. And just a general reminder, you do need to go through the chair. With that, I'm going to move on to our next Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question to Representative Noor. On line 7.8, other health care grants, talking about $5 million in fiscal year 2024 for outreach efforts. So could you just kind of give us an explanation of what that outreach looks like? Are you doing some sort of outreach now? If so, is it successful? And then if I may have one quick follow-up commentary or question after that. Quick.
Thank you, Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think as the Assistant Commissioner noted when we were talking about the unwinding, there's ongoing work that is happening right now. There are a few things in terms of updating addresses and making sure we have the accurate information about the recipients. So that is an ongoing process. What this is to make sure that we encourage folks to renew their cases using multiple process that the department will deploy. So this will be a process that we are hoping the Department of Human Services will deploy to ensure that we reach every corner in the state and every individual who is eligible to be able to renew their case.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you. Representative Noor, the reason why I asked that because it sometimes when we do these dollars to a department for outreach of some sort, we find out after the fact that the money has been spent in frivolous ways. So I'm just going back to Minshore. I don't know if you were around when we did the Minshore, but you know there was dollars spent, quite a bit of dollars spent for outreach on Minshore, making sure people were signing up for that program. And what we found out is we would go to the restaurants, and in the back of the bathroom stalls would be a billboard saying, hey, sign up for Minsure. Or you'd go to the restaurant, and there would be coasters with the Minsure coasters in. While the department may have thought that was a really great way of letting people know, right, in a bathroom stall, taxpayers were really upset that this was the form of outreach. So I just want to be very cognizant and just put it on the record that I would hope that the department has learned its lessons from the Minsure debacle on outreach and be a little bit more respectful with the taxpayer dollars, Ms. Chair and Representative Noor. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Noor, before we head to a vote, do you have any follow-up or closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think the issue of what is needed, $5 million isn't enough to go throughout the state. I can assure you that the department will do their utmost care in terms of making sure that the process that they deploy will reflect what is needed across the state. With that, Madam Chair, I just wanted to renew my motion that House File
2286
be referred to the Health Policy and Finance Committee.
Thank you, Chair Noor. And with that, we are going to go ahead and go to a vote. The motion on the table is to refer House File 2286 to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. It appears the ayes have it. That motion passes, and House File 2286 has been re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. With that, we will call Representative Greenman to the table, and I will get out of the way, and we can have Chair Noor back here.
Welcome, Representative Greenman. So with that, I move House File 3 to be re-referred to Judiciary Committee. Please introduce the bill and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it is great to be here. I've heard it's a lively discussion, and I'm looking forward to the conversation on this bill. House File 3 is the Democracy for the People Act, which is a comprehensive democracy legislation that invests, protects, and strengthens Minnesota's best traditions of voter participation, sound election administration, and grassroots people power democracy. We've heard and discussed this bill fully in elections, and it has a lot of stops, so I'll confine my remarks to the part of the bill under the jurisdiction of HHS Finance, which is modernizing our voter registration system to include automatic voter registration when eligible citizens apply for Minnesota Care medical assistance. This common sense policy removes barriers to voter registration for eligible voters and ensures that every eligible voter who wishes to participate in our democracy can. Voter registration has long been a barrier to participation in Minnesota, in general. In Minnesota, we have a proud and long tradition of working to remove those barriers. As the first state in the nation to adopt same-day registration, Minnesota was on the forefront of expanding access to the ballot. But nearly 50 years later, our system needs modernization and still leaves far too many people out. According to our census, the current population survey, non-registered eligible voters tend to be younger, lower income, less educated, and more likely to be BIPOC than registered voters. And administrative barriers like voter registration are an unnecessary hurdle to participation in our democracy. Nearly half of a century later, we have the opportunity to take the next step to modernizing our system, ensuring that our voter rolls reflect Minnesotan citizenry, and to ensure we have a safe, secure, accurate, and accessible system. With this modernization, Minnesota can improve the efficiency of our system and increase the accuracy and security of our rolls. So here's how it works. When an eligible Minnesotan applies for Minnesota care or medical assistance and provides the agency with the information that they're eligible to vote, their address, their age, and proof of citizenship, all information that they're already providing, DHS will securely submit that application, transmit that applicant's information to the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State will run the same verification checks that they do with all registrants, and then voters will get a postcard alerting them to their eligibility and offering them the opportunity to decline registration. After the 20-year opt-out, or the 20-day, excuse me, opt-out period, eligible voters will be added to the registration rolls if they don't decline to register. And after that, any voter who wishes to cancel their registration can do so at any time. And it works the same way for registered voters updating their registration with a new address. They'll be mailed the notice with their address updated and offered the opportunity to decline that update if they wish. This modernization will expand access to voter registration and prove the efficiency, the accuracy, and the security of our voter registration system. It'll help reach folks that are currently not being reached by our current system and that won't be reached by the DVS. Elderly folks, low-income folks, folks on these more likely to be on these programs. As a voting rights lawyer who's worked on democracy policy across the country, I can tell you that automatic voter registration is a good reform that strengthens access and security. That's why it's been enacted in Alaska, Colorado, Oregon, and 19 other states. So with that, Mr. Chair, I believe we have a few testifiers, and then I think we can get to questions.
Thank you so much, Representative Grimm. I do have two individuals who signed up to testify. First one is Catherine Harrison. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. Lindell Sorensen, if you can come close by. Please introduce yourself and proceed with the testimony.
All right. Hi, my name is Catherine Harrison. I'm a member of the Minnesota Public Health Association. Good afternoon, committee members, and thank you, Chair Noor, for the opportunity to testify in support of HF3. As I mentioned, my name is Catherine Harrison. I reside in New Brighton, House District 40A, with my husband and three young children. I am a registered nurse and a public health professional and a member of the Minnesota Public Health Association. I love public health. In my career, I have had the opportunity to work on college student health, global maternal and child health, climate change and health equity, and almost everything in between. Along the way, I have been grounded and guided by the basic definition of my profession, which says that public health is what we do to assure the conditions for people to be healthy. Robust democratic processes are vital for this assurance. Our public health theories and definitions tell us this, but so does the data. Research from the Health and Democracy Index found that communities with higher voter participation enjoy better health outcomes, including but not limited to lower premature mortality rates, lower adult disability rates, fewer poor mental health days, and better self-reported health. Ensuring representative democratic decision-making is also a means to health equity. But there is a cost to voting. Minnesota is ranked 15th of all states in terms of the time and effort it takes to cast a ballot. So while we are doing better compared to many states, there's more we can do to protect and expand democracy. Research has shown a negative correlation between those enrolled in Medicaid and voter registration. Including AVR within DHS would dramatically improve this voter registration for low-income Minnesotans and increase opportunities for improved health and well-being. Not being registered to vote is the number one reason given for not voting, and AVR would alleviate unnecessary administrative barriers to inclusion. We in the public health community know that community health and well-being would be considerably improved by the passage of HF3. Just last year, the Minnesota Public Health Association passed a voter registration and participation resolution to support policies like those included in HF3. I urge the committee to pass this bill and the provision to enact AVR. Doing so will empower Minnesotans to assure the conditions for a healthy future for ourselves and our communities. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person I have on the list is Lindell Sorensen. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Lindell Sorensen, medical student at the University of Minnesota and fellow with Advocates for Better Health. Thank you for having me today, Chair Noor and committee members, and for the opportunity to share with you today my support for House File 3. Like I said, my name is Lindell Sorensen. I live in District 63A. I'm a second-year medical student at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities, and a public health fellow with Advocates for Better Health, a public health and advocacy organization in Minnesota. I'm also a longtime Minnesota resident and mom to a lively two-year-old. And when I reflect on my hope for my son and his peers, I find that I really focus on well-being, his well-being, the well-being of those in his community, and ultimately that comes down to the vibrancy and resilience of our shared social fabric. And the backbone for much of that is voting and the access that makes it possible. So voting matters for health. When we as Minnesotans are healthier and more connected to our neighbors, our voices are stronger and our institutions are more accountable. Minnesota is a fantastic state when it comes to many measures of accessible elections, such as Election Day voter registration and protecting accessibility by rejecting exclusionary voter ID laws. But as a state, we could do better. Minnesota doesn't even crack the top quartile for voting access, according to the Cost of Voting Index. House File 3 is the next step for Minnesota in protecting and strengthening the freedom to vote. One key provision in House File 3 includes establishing secure, automatic voter registration when eligible voters interact with a government agency such as DHS or the DVS. The number one reason people do not vote is simply because they're not registered. Currently, roughly 1.5 million low-income Minnesotans are enrolled in Minnesota Medical Assistance. Allowing these beneficiaries to register to vote through automatic voter registration while enrolling in medical assistance would improve social cohesion and ensure a more inclusive democracy. This is the future that I want for my son and for Minnesotans as a whole, one that recognizes the linkage between voter participation and healthy communities. And the data proves it. Improved social cohesion leads to better overall mental and physical health. Considering that voting often takes time, focus, and planning, boosting its accessibility through proven approaches would be pivotal in ensuring all Minnesotans are enfranchised in the widest sense of the word. By recognizing access to voting as a social determinant to health, through House File 3, the legislature has an opportunity to ensure conditions that create thriving communities. Thank you so much for considering this testimony and for the work you do through your public service. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you so much for your testimony. With that, I think we will give each member who has got a question, one question. So we'll start with Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think we need to correct the record and let the members know that there was a inaccurate statement given from the chair on the during the previous bill about sections of this bill, that it was optional, when on 814 you've got must ensure. This is for DHS, which is in the purview of this committee. 814 must ensure, 819 must ensure, 822 must contain, 823 and 24 must transmit information daily, 825 must submit, 828 must submit, and then for other agencies on 9.5 and 6, other state agencies must implement AVR. The language of this bill is not optional, and we need to straighten that out and understand the costs, the effects on the previous bill, and frankly, I just felt that we needed to correct the inaccurate statement made earlier in the committee on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Plum. Colleague Pizzotto. Representative Pizzotto.
Thank you, Chair Noor and Representative Greenman, for bringing this bill forward. On this committee and on all the committees, we talk about a lot of efficiency and effectiveness. And my birthday was last week. I went to renew my driver's license, and I already have a real ID. They already have all the data, so I didn't have to, you know, bring in all the extra forms. I did have to, I verified that when I checked in, because, you know, when they would check in, if you have to leave to go get stuff, then they take you off the list if you miss your time, so that they can move on to the next person and help people as quickly as possible. But I didn't need to bring anything else, so they already have all my information, and then, you know, I didn't have to re-register to vote because my address wasn't changing. But when they have all the information needed to make the decision and to make sure that I am eligible to vote at my current address, I think that that not only makes it more efficient from the government's perspective, but from the perspective of Minnesotans. And I think that, that's something that can be lost in our discussions. You know, we want to make sure that things are effective and efficient, that we're spending the taxpayers' money as wisely as possible. But we also want to make life easier for Minnesotans. And I think that this bill does that, particularly this section, because if folks are already qualified to vote, we've already provided the information necessary, let's make sure that they can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Katiswatun. That's exactly it. Why do we make people continue to fill out the same information on different paperwork, right? We talk about that all the time. What this is saying is, if you've already provided that information, who you say you are, your age, and then verification of citizenship through these programs you're required to by federal law, that should be sent along to the Secretary of State's office, who runs all the same checks as if you'd registered on a voter registration card.
I just also wanted to note, on page 7 of the combined application, that question of registration is actually asked if someone wanted to do the application for programs. That has existed for many years that I've worked for the county. I just wanted to put that on the record. So that question is on the application, the combined application that many individuals fill for.
Mr. Chair, is that submitted daily or must be submitted daily?
Representative Grimm, I'll give you the quick
response. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's not actually the subject of this bill. I know that we don't have much time. The Secretary of State's office is here. What this bill does is require that transmission happens, but currently under Minnesota law, they include, right, but what I'm saying is, current law, what Chair Noor is talking about, I'm not exactly sure what the transmission time is. What this law does is require that to be transmitted daily. But it also takes out the front-end burden of having to fill out that additional work.
Representative Zalesnik.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. My observation and comment is just simply, you know, there isn't a person I know that doesn't have this. Regardless of where we live in the state of Minnesota, we have access to, you know, get whatever we want online. And I feel like the underlying message of teaching personal responsibility, like I was taught in civics class, I'm not sure if we have civics class in high school anymore, but in 10th grade, the civics class was clearly described to me, and I've clearly articulated that to those I'm in my life. And my other observation is that it seems it just innately violates everything I was taught about HIPAA. We take people's information from one intent, from a medical enrollment or another enrollment, and we're using it then for another enrollment. So that's concerning to me. And so it's just my healthcare background. It's concerning to me. It feels like a violation to people. And so I think that having people vote is a priority for all of us. I just think I look at getting there a different way, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've thoroughly discussed these bills in the past.
It's nice to be back with you, New Brindley.
I would just make a couple of comments. I mean, just first, I have so much respect for Representative Greenman. However, this bill was not fully discussed in the Elections Committee. As we talked about on the floor, many members of that committee were not able to ask questions, make comments. So this bill was not fully discussed in the Elections Committee. In fact, that this bill particularly was problematic in that committee in that it was not fully discussed. And just adding on, you know, what Representative Zalesnikar said, you know, and thank you, Chair Knorr, for pointing out that currently on these applications, there is a box to check where someone can register to vote. Interestingly, what this language will do, whereas right now it's very easy for someone to check that box when they are making that application, what this will do is put an enormous burden on the individual if they want to opt out. It automatically puts them in the system, and then the timelines are tight, and it is cumbersome for the individual. Checking a box during the application process, super easy. And happens all the time, I am sure. I suspect Chair Knorr could tell us more about that. But checking a box during the application process to opt in, very easy process. Opting out under this language, much more cumbersome. For one, you have 20 days from the date of the mailing. So that means that that mailing goes out, the person may receive it 5 days later, 10 days later in today's day and age. I mean, we've got areas that like literally don't get mail every day right now. The post office doesn't even deliver every day. So for some reason, there is a very short timeline on this within 20 days of the date of the mailing. And the entire burden is on the individual to then go through that process of opting out. Whereas right now, they already have the ability, when they're making this application, to opt in. And as Representative Zalesnikar said, this does call into question some privacy issues, where folks are filling out an application for medical assistance or something else, where they already have the option to opt in if they would choose to, but now they don't have the option to say no, do not transmit my information to the Secretary of State. I don't want you to do that, which also creates other issues because, you know, right now there are folks who there that we have lists where folks can opt out of having their voter information made public. And now that creates a situation where those folks have a burdensome process to now go back and say, wait a minute, I don't want to be on this list. I need my personal information hidden from public view, because once you're on a voter registration list, that information is public. You know, I mean, frankly, I work on campaigns. I know how this works. And once you are a registered voter, that is public information. And so this places a huge burden on folks who may not want to be on that list to now remove themselves, rather than very easily, as the current system does, checking a box to be included. This provision particularly is really problematic. And I would just end by saying, you know, we talk about how registration is a barrier. I mean, it's an odd argument to make in a state that is often number one in voter participation across the country. And frankly, we also heard some strange implications of public health and participating in democracy. Frankly, if you've got public health issues, it is not caused by your lack of participation in democracy. There are a lot of things at play that are making your life difficult. And this is likely the least of your worries. However, you might be worried about your information becoming public and the burden that places on you to make sure that that's not the case.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so since I have one question, I'm going to make some comments before I ask my question. So we have absentee voting starts 46 days prior to an election. I just want on record, if people are having issues voting, we have 46 days before the election to cast that ballot. So I don't know why we have to hold people's hands during this process. I mean, so there's that. And then let's see here. Governor, the governor has said that he will pass with or without GOP support election bills that are passed to him. In the previous, we have had an agreement that there would be bipartisan support. So in this bill that is, and I also want it on the record, we are not a democracy. We are a constitutional republic. There is a difference there. And so we hear this democracy, democracy, democracy. We're actually a republic. But this bill titled We the People Act, I am not really seeing much of We the People, because to my knowledge, zero Republican input has been accepted on this House File 3, one of the, well, it's the third priority of the Democrats, third after abortion. So I am just very curious how this bill can be titled We the People Act if you are eliminating the voice of conservatives in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Franson. It gives me a good opportunity to talk about how all this is not about us. This is not about whether Democrats and Republican lawmakers can decide. This is about how it impacts voters in our communities. This is good policy that will expand access for Democrats, for Republicans, frankly, for folks with no party at all. And all of this policy, including automatic voter registration, has been adopted in states that are controlled by Republicans and states that are controlled by Democrats. And so, I do want to correct the record about this. You know, we hear a lot about this bipartisan agreement. It's come out of the mouths of a few governors, but the reality is that in 2012, a Republican-controlled legislature passed voter ID and put it on the ballot with no Democrats. So I think that the reality is, and I appreciate what you just said, what we're looking at is this good for Democrat, Republican, and independent voters? We're looking at the last election where voters came out and said that they want to not just protect, not just participate, but protect democracy. And so when I think about what's in this bill, what we're talking about is not whether it's good for Democrat and Republican elected officials, but whether it's good for the people of Minnesota, and that's how it was put together.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Greenman. Quick question. One of the testifiers, I'm sorry I forgot her name, but the University of Minnesota, stated that 1.5 million people are on assistance, or you're using MnShare or MA that would qualify under this. But of that 1.5 million, how many are minors? You talk about 40% of the 1.5, well, of that, how many is it? You know, 1.5 million. There's just a little glitch on that because it looks bigger than it is, and I want to know what that, of that 1.5 million that are using, how many can do you know that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Gilman. It's nice to meet you. So you are right that this bill would only apply. You have to be eligible to vote. You have to be 18. And so the application of it would be adults. And so I don't know the answer. That's actually probably better for the HHS staff than a voting auxiliary. But I do know that there's a significant amount of adults on both Minnesota Care and Medicaid. And so we can get that answer for you. But you're right that we're talking about folks who are over 18.
Yep. So my final thing is, could we, is anybody from DHS here that would know that?
We will request the data of how many adults in the Medicaid and Minnesota Care program. So we'll get you the number on that one. So the final question or statement from Vice Chair Bynum.
Thank you. I think it's probably no surprise that I could talk on this bill for quite some time, having had it for the last 4 years. But I will try to be brief. I did want to draw folks' attention to specifically and to clarify that my statements, if you look on lines 8.30 through 9.3, there is a series of checkpoints here to make sure that DHS is fully capable and ready to be able to transmit this information for the purposes of voting, that they do have the data that is necessary to do so. So I just want to make sure that it is clear that that is specifically the section that we're talking about. In that, it also makes reference in 9.3 4 through 9.6 to make sure that other units of government, should they in a future time decide to take this up, that they are working with the governor and the secretary of state to determine that they do have access to the data and that it can properly be tested and transmitted if necessary. I did also want to point out that HIPAA is really about a national standard that protects sensitive patient information, specifically patient information dealing with someone's individual health. What we are talking about here is specifically relaying data that has to do with someone's citizenship, which relates to eligibility to vote and to be registered to vote. We are not relaying personal health information on any patient. That would be illegal. And so I just want to make sure that we're clear on that distinction, because this is the Human Services Committee, and we are specifically dealing with the DHS provision under, I believe it is, Section 2. And so I just want to make that distinction. And that said, you know, we have some of the highest voter participation in the entire country. That is a distinction I think we are all exceptionally proud of. But what we've identified today, and I want to thank the testifiers who came up from the Minnesota Public Health Association, the Advocates for Better Health, we have folks from Human Services, you know, really noticed that there is one area where we haven't always done as good when it comes to automatic voter registration, I should say. And, you know, the point of this bill is that we talk about it being automatic, but it really isn't. It's a bit of a misnomer. We go through routine checks and balances. There are multiple areas in which we use to vet the specific information before we ever get to a registration, which means that we have cleaner, crisper rolls at the polls when you go to that point in order to be able to exercise your right to vote. And I think that making sure that we address the gaps that we've identified here today make good sense. And certainly I know that Minnesotans like the distinction of being number one in the nation year after year after year. And this provision in particular allows us to not only to maintain that distinction, but to step it up even one more level. And so I appreciate that. And thank you, Representative Greenman.
Thank you so much. We don't have much time. I'd like to renew my motion that House File 3 be referred to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
The motion prevails, and you're on your way to the Judiciary Committee. With that, we don't have further agenda items. We are now adjourned.